Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. On our show today, we're a nation of hoarders. The problem is not old copies of Reader's Digest, though. It's not snowmobile engines or elastic bands. No, Canadians hoard loyalty points. $16 billion worth. We'll talk about this startling number and what you can do about it. And millennials need lots of things, but is life insurance one of them? Or is the push to sell this demographic new products just a push for profit? I don't know. We'll talk about that. Then from millennials to baby boomers, the aging population presents new challenges when it comes to personal finance. But how exactly do you open up the conversation with your parents or with your kids? Plus, a problem most of us would love to have, how to deal with sudden wealth. Let's get started. Canadians love loyalty programs. If we save for retirement as aggressively as we save our points, most of us would be on a cruise around the world right now. But that is not the case. According to a recent report, as a country, we are sitting on a total of over $16 billion in points. Scott Robinson is VP Design and Strategy, Bond Brand Loyalty, the firm that published the report. Hello there, Scott.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
$16 billion. That's a lot of money. Why is it so high?
Well, I think marketers and program operators would look at that number as promises or thank yous waiting to be fulfilled. Certainly, Canadians love their loyalty programs and participate in over seven of them. So, yes, $16 billion is a large number, and marketers can't wait to fulfill those promises.
Do they want to fulfill the promises, really? Because when I talk to consumers, one of the things that they get jazzed about is seeing that balance increase, tick, 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 tick up. And yet your report says you're more satisfied if you redeem. Canadians aren't redeeming. So wouldn't the marketers be happier if we took advantage of the free Moulinex hand blender in the flight?
Well, I think the CFO might be, but the marketer certainly would say otherwise. Brands are looking to keep track of the ways in which consumers are interacting with brands and with their programs. And so points is a good tracking metric to say, here's how much you've engaged with us, and here's the size of the thank you we'd like to provide in return.
Even if you never take advantage of it.
Well, again, and I think if customers and consumers aren't taking advantage of their points balance, A, they may not yet be aware of those, so maybe a bit of a marketer shortcoming. One of the things our study said to us is that 54% of participants aren't really aware of the points balance they're sitting on. So I think program operators and marketers need to do a good job to say, hey, member, you have this amount of points in our program, and we'd invite you to redeem for one of these things.
I was in a grocery store on the weekend, and the person in front of me said she stopped collecting points because after 20 years, all she got was a blender. And her friend said, yeah, but you got a free blender. So I think there are two very different consumer mindsets about points reflected in that anecdote. What do you know about how the different ways in which consumers engage?
Yeah, well, I think as consumers are complex beings. As human beings, we're emotional, we're rational. We're individual, we're social, and the things that motivate consumers, there's a lot of them, and the things that motivate one person may be different than that which motivates another. What we know from the study is that two-thirds of what drives satisfaction in these programs isn't necessarily the point or the reward. In fact, it's the experience. And so the example of two patrons in a store talking about it's been years since I started collecting, one of them might value the experience more than they would value the reward.
What are some of the big themes for points programs in the future, do you think?
Well, ease and experience, the role of people. Certainly to further the point I was just making around the experience is two-thirds of the story. When we look at brands like, say, Amazon Prime and how easy it is for participants and members to add an item to their cart and how easy it is for that service to get an item that somebody wants to buy right to their doorstep, that speaks volumes about the experience. Amazon's using technology in interesting ways. We can go to our desktop and add an item to our cart. We can even push a little button called the Amazon Dash button and simply replenish something that we're missing in our household and have that arrive at our doorstep the next day.
So that may be gold standard, less than gold standard for air miles recently with the points expiry controversy. Do you think some of that negative PR is going to lead to changes here in Canada?
Well, I think what's important to consumers, as it is in any relationship, is trust. And so when a program or a brand establishes a relationship with its customers, it's doing so on the basis of trust. And so when the rules of engagement, like, say, points expiry change, in a way that hasn't been transparent or is a surprise to participants, it erodes that trust and it calls into action or calls into to question that relationship. Certainly, Air Miles is a tenured program in the Canadian marketplace, and many Canadians are likely enrolled in that program. And so when the trust with that brand is eroded, it has consumers evaluate their relationship with that brand.
Now, basic rule of thumb, 100 points equals a buck or two or so. Is the behavior that the marketer is asking for worth the points that consumers receive if a consumer was really aware of what the dollar value of that point was?
Well, consumers are very savvy and marketers are increasingly transparent. Points are a tool and a mechanism that brands and programs have used to say, in exchange for these behaviors that we'd love to see from you, here is what we're willing to offer in return. And so whether it's perhaps smaller or less valuable types of behaviors like share our brand on social or tweet about our brand or post it to your page versus simply other things like make a purchase. Marketers and program operators value different behaviors differently, and so they use points in different amounts to say, here's how much we value that behavior.
One of the other data points that struck me was the goal orientation and the connection that that had to satisfaction. Tell us about those numbers and what you infer from them.
Well, one of the things we know about human behavior is that humans pursue an objective more vigorously the closer they get to that objective. So the closer we are to a goal, the more vigorously we'll pursue it. Consumers without a goal and members and programs who are accumulating points without a goal or without a purpose tend to be less satisfied. And so it's the marketer's job, it's the program's job to help encourage participants to set a goal, because what we know is we'll pursue goals more vigorously the closer we get to them. So simply declaring a goal or setting a goal is an important program mechanic.
All right, this last question is for you as an individual versus you as an expert in the loyalty world. How do you use points? What are your personal hacks? What would you say to your best friend, to your mother, to someone else who you really wanted to make best use of their points? What are the inside tricks? I promise I will tell no one what you say.
That's a great question. Well, for me, I think I'm unique in that I wear many hats at the same time. I'm both a consumer as I am a loyalty guy, and so it's tough for me to discern. But what I would tell friends and family and even colleagues and our clients is that focus on what's important to them. Choose programs that fulfill the needs you have from that brand. It's easy to be lured by a monetary incentive, and yet that isn't the stuff that keeps us engaged. I value being able to board a plane first. I value things like getting a complimentary room upgrade when I stay at a hotel. I value the way that a representative of a brand or a program talks to me in a very personalized way. And so those are the things that I'm doing to encourage our clients to engender better loyalty with our clients or with our customers. And those are the things that ignite me as a consumer as well.
And not 12.2 programs. That's got to be too many programs.
Well, loyalty doesn't reward promiscuity. And so consumers are – loyalty programs, that is, doesn't reward promiscuity. And so while consumers are enrolled in 12-plus programs – they are active in only about 7, and so too would program operators want them to be engaged in only a few. Programs value loyalty, and when consumers consolidate their engagement, consolidate their spend with a specific or a select brand, that behavior and that loyalty is rewarded.
And the magic number may just be 7? Is that the number?
Well, the magic number just may be 7. In fact, what we've been seeing in the 7 years that we've been undertaking this study is that consumers have sort of an engagement threshold or an engagement capacity. We're not seeing that number go any higher than 7. Consumers consolidate their spend. Marketers wouldn't want that number to be 12 out of 12 because that's the promiscuity that programs shouldn't be rewarding.
I love the use of that word in this conversation. Scott, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. We always love chatting about this topic. So thanks for the conversation with you as well.
Scott Robinson is VP Design and Strategy with Bond Brand Loyalty. The oldest of the millennial cohort are celebrating their 37th birthday this year.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Kids, they grow up so fast. Many of them have homes, spouses, even kids, the full deal. Now, if you have dependents, life insurance is a no-brainer. But what if you don't? Should millennials buy life insurance? Lauren Mars, Director of New Business with LSM Insurance. He joins us now. Hello there.
How you doing, Bruce?
Do you ever say someone doesn't need insurance?
Well, it definitely some people need it more than others. If they don't have any dependents, and if the if it's a millennial who's the other spouse isn't dependent on them, or if they're not connected at all, then yeah, there probably wouldn't be much of a need for life insurance.
So some have dependents, obviously 37, they could have five kids by that time period. Is that really the tipping point for you, or the milestone that has you say, listen, this is now inevitable, this needs to happen?
Yeah. Definitely when you have kids, unless you're very wealthy and there's no need for insurance and you have no debt, which wouldn't be most millennials, then there would be a need for life insurance. Because when you have a child, it's not like the child can go to work if something happens to you. So that's why, in the truest sense of the form, they're dependent.
If you have no dependents, but you do have a bunch of debt, let's say most of it is student debt, what happens if you were to die?
Well, yeah, if that would be taken away from your from any other assets that you have. So if you had a... there may be someone who's connected and they may have a house or any other kind of property or any other type of assets. That debt would be removed from those assets.
What if you don't? What if you're, working your job and you're living in a rental, maybe you have a car but not much else? Who has to repay that debt, or does anybody?
Well, nobody. I mean, they'd be a line of creditors that they wouldn't get paid if there were no assets to cover that debt.
How does one figure out how much life insurance they need?
There's some rules of thumb, and there's also some different needs analysis tools that we have on our site, as well as some other sites that you can see on the internet. But a rule of thumb is usually if someone has dependents under 10 years of age, they'd want to have 10 times their annual income. And if they had dependents over 10 years of age, then they'd look at five times their annual income. But that's, once again, just a rule of thumb that could be, different circumstances. If someone has a large mortgage or other large amounts of debt, they may need more than that.
And if they didn't have, in the case where they didn't have dependents and really they were buying it to safeguard their estate from having to pay the student debt off or whatever the debt was, would the rule of thumb be different?
Yeah, the rule of thumb would definitely be different if they didn't have any dependents. Then it would just be a matter of paying off the debt.
Of course, there's term life and then there's permanent life insurance. Totally different framework there. What is your advice for millennials on term versus permanent, either whole or the other options, universal, I guess?
Yeah, so the term insurance is going to give you a very affordable initial option because you can get it anywhere from a 10 to a 40-year term. One of the most common is a 20-year term. And what that would do, if you look at the example of a 20-year term, it's going to give you rates level for the first 20 years, and it's going to go up as you get older. Now, for people that have a lot of debt and not a lot of money to outlay, the term's going to be a good route. The other, if you can swing a permanent in your budget and you don't have and you have the money to do it, the advantage is you're going to be locking it at a very low rate. So someone who's taking out a policy when they're 25, a permanent policy, it's going to be much less expensive
than someone who wanted to look at that permanent policy when they're 45 or 50. So it's it really depends on your overall situation, what your goals are, and what your budget is. It determines which is the best scenario for someone in terms of life insurance.
How much commission does a broker earn on a term life policy versus on a whole life policy? Because I know for fantastic brokers, they're listening to their clients' needs and they're really, you know, they're matching up a product to those needs. But then there are those who may be influenced by their ability to earn a better commission on a whole or a permanent life policy.
It's an interesting question. I mean, the commission generally is based on the premium. So, I mean, certain companies pay more on certain permanent policies than on term policies, but some permanent policies actually pay a lower percentage commission rate than a term policy. For example, a Term 100 policy, which is a level premium policy with no cash values, the commission rates on that can actually be lower than a term policy, but it's really a function of the premium. So if someone's taking out a $2,000 a year premium, it's going to be a much higher commission than someone who takes out a $300 a year premium. But keep in mind that someone who takes out a 10-year term might be taking out a new policy every 10 years over three or four, you know, maybe do it three or five or six times in their lifetime. So the actual commission that they pay out over their lifetime could be much higher on a term policy if they keep taking out more policies as they get older.
And let's make a simple assumption that the term life policy costs $100 a month, $1,200 a year. In dollar terms, what does that mean the consumer is paying to the broker, to the insurance company, all that? And the reason I ask is we've talked so much in recent years about investing fees and having consumers be really clear on what it is that they're paying. And I want to do the same service to their investigation of where insurance fits in.
Sure. So the commission, you know, it's really going to depend on the broker's, on the insurance company's commission rate and the broker's bonus rate. But as a, once again, as a rule of thumb, you're looking at roughly a dollar for every dollar of premium, a dollar of commission. So if someone's paying $1,200 a year, the first year commission would be about $1,200. Now, if that policy cancels during the first 2 years, there's generally a chargeback. And there's a small renewal each year, so a small renewal commission. So if someone's paying $1,200 a year, the broker would make money in the first year, and then they would make a small renewal commission each year after. Might be, you know, depending on the carrier, might be $30 to $40 a year thereafter. But keep in mind that that pricing is factored into the premium. So if you look at a bank-sold product, that same product is the commissions, or the, I wouldn't say the commission, but the salaries priced into the premium. So it's really, you know, it's the, I guess it's debatable where there's a higher distribution cost. If there's a higher distribution cost paying the commission or paying the salary. If it were a higher distribution cost paying the commission, most insurance companies would probably pay salary to everyone.
Millennials are tech savvy. They live on their phones. Most Canadians live on their phones, but millennials in particular. When will we see some serious innovation, technological innovation, in the way that millennials and everyone can buy insurance? Because it hasn't arrived yet.
Some companies it's arrived to a certain degree, but I agree that the insurance companies are generally paper. It's a paper-heavy industry. But a lot of companies, Humania is one, Assumption Life's another, have made big improvements with their electronic applications. There's also been a strong push towards simplified issue type policies, where they ask a shorter series of questions, but they can do the underwriting immediately, so people don't have to meet with a nurse, or you know, they don't have to do all of the long form type of applications, but that can add a little bit of an extra premium to the cost of the policy because the insurance company has less information to analyze the risk.
Interesting. Lauren, we'll leave it there for today. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Lauren Maher is Director of New Business with LSM Insurance. Coming up later on Moolala, 4% of life insurance applications in Canada are declined. what to do if that's you. But next, do you have adult children or do you have aging parents? You're going to want to stick around to hear our next conversation. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry on Facebook. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. I'm Bruce Ellery. More and more seniors are needing help to deal with their financial struggles. According to data from the Credit Counseling Society, people over the age of 55 now represent 21% of its client base, compared to just 5% 20 years ago. Scott Hanna is the president and CEO with the Credit Counseling Society of BC. He joins us now from New Westminster, British Columbia. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Bruce.
This is a big increase. I know we're talking about 20 years, but still a big increase over time. Why?
Well, this for a number of reasons. You know, certainly we're seeing that defined pensions are going the way of a dodo bird. We're seeing that adult children are staying home longer. And people, unfortunately, are having to look after their elder parents. And so with wages not keeping up with inflation, certainly investment returns being erratic, in some cases lower than the past, and rates on interest savings accounts historically low, it makes it difficult for a person to be able to save enough and get ahead and look after their retirement needs.
So what are some examples of issues that you're seeing? The seniors pick up the phone and call you. This is, people tend to be in really tough circumstances before they type that credit counseling phrase into Google.
Well, fortunately, we're seeing more people who are acknowledging their situation a little earlier, which is great to see. But we're seeing people that who are retiring with credit card debt and are managing for a period of time until they reach the end of their limits and realize that they can't fit the minimum payment into the budget given the income that's been reduced over time. We're also seeing people that have been used to helping family and friends no longer in that position, but as a result, find themselves in a worsening financial picture. Then, of course, you look at a person's medical condition. People don't realize that when you get older, the high cost of maintaining your health, and for many people, it breaks their bank accounts.
CIBC released a poll recently, which points out, I think, something that's obvious, but bears mentioning. 90% of Canadians with parents over the age of 65 feel it's important to discuss how to manage their parents' finances, but 66% haven't done so. What are the hurdles to having that conversation?
A lot of it is attitude, and certainly looking at a senior population who was never used to discussing finances with their kids, it's difficult to bring up that subject. I know in my own parents' case, when the time was needed to have that conversation, it was difficult for my mother, but she understood the importance of it. And so for a lot of people, it's tough, especially for adult kids who've looked upon their parents over decades are the ones who provide them guidance, advice, now finding themselves in that position where they're the ones that really have to help out with mom and dad looking after their finances.
Who should raise the issue and when?
I think that it's if the parents aren't raising it when they're in their mid-60s, it's up to their children to raise it with them.
Right.
And to do so before they're in financial difficulty or perhaps going through a difficult period of time, depression and illness. It's never easy managing during a crisis, so always do it in advance of one if you can.
What does that sentence sound like? Because some people say, oh, yeah, I agree in theory. Sure, I should have this conversation. I don't know what words to apply to that request.
I think it's easy, if I reflect back on my own situation. My mom's saying, Mom, while things are okay right now, things can change when you get older. And so I want to have a conversation with you about your finances, making sure that you're okay, understanding what your wishes are so that when the time comes, they can be carried out, but also to help you. I want to be there as a person you can ask questions of. If you're not sure about something, I want to be there to help you. It's going to be non-judgmental. You've always provided that advice and guidance to me, and I've trusted you. I want to do the same for you.
That was great. I bet some of our listeners are going to be like rewinding this online and like transcribing what you said, or maybe they'll just play it. I can't have the conversation, but listen to this guy. He's going to bring up a topic for us. What should be included in this conversation? What are the buckets?
I think it's important that we look at, does your mom and dad have enough money going forward to meet their monthly and annual expenditures? So making sure that they're comfortable. And looking at, what are their future needs? How are they going to manage those? At one point in time, you know, unless we're fortunate, we're in our 99th year, we just don't wake up one morning, a lot of us are going to need assisted living. And how are we going to manage those expenses, those copes? So looking at what our needs are today, when they're hopefully in reasonable health, how their needs may change and what that looks like from a financial perspective, and the assets. How are they going to manage that? What are they going to do with their house? Mm. Is the house free and encumbered? Are they intending to use that house as part of their last phase of their life in terms of managing assisted living so that their golden years remain golden?
Many Canadians work with financial advisors, including a lot of seniors. How should the kids be involved in that relationship?
They should be encouraging their parents to allow them to attend those meetings with them. And I think that most financial advisors do a terrific job of advising their clients and keeping their money safe, especially as they get older.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it provides comfort and guidance to parents when their children, who are up to date on these matters, can provide that extra bit of confidence and ask questions that many seniors are afraid to ask of their financial advisors. I know when I switched my own financial advisor after a 10-year relationship, even though I know he wasn't doing as good a job as he should have for me, it was still difficult breaking up with that relationship.
Mm.
And that's with someone who has a fair bit of knowledge and expertise. So it's more difficult for seniors to do so. So having their children with them, who can ask those objective but direct questions to make sure their parents are getting the right advice so their parents have sufficient funds to manage throughout the rest of their lives.
One of the things the actuarial tables tell us is that women tend to outlive men. So in a heterosexual couple, it is predictable that the female will live longer. How does that nuance get managed? Because often, and I'm stereotyping here, generalizing here, the man takes the lead in many families on the investing piece of personal finance in particular.
They certainly do, and certainly with our senior population, it's the man has traditionally taken that lead, and it's something to transition over with. I think it's important with adult children, but even with older couples, saying we've got to share this information and knowledge. I know with my own wife, who is very trusting of me, you know, our financial planner meets with my wife independently of me just to make sure she understands everything, and I support that. So you have a good understanding and knowledge about what to do when the time comes. And I think that's a real important transition piece for adult children, that when, regrettably, their father passes on, now it's mom on her own, who may not have that confidence, that in advance of that you're having those conversations. We're going to be here for you to make sure you manage okay so you don't have to worry. And that takes a lot of pressure off of their shoulders.
One last question. What are some of the early warning signs that kids should be aware of as it relates to their aging parents? That, things might not be going as they should be going, and maybe mom and dad aren't talking to me about things. Is, you know, are you opening their fridge and seeing if they have food? What should they be watching for?
We know, and that's one of the telltale signs, but also even verbal frustrations with their bank or bank account. They're having difficulty managing it. Also watching out for the fact that if they're taking strong medications that are impacting their judgment in one area of their life, it may be impacting their finances as well. But also looking at, you know, do you see credit card statements coming into the home? And while there's nothing wrong with using credit cards for safety and convenience, certainly you shouldn't be using them to carry a balance on them.
Mm.
As well as signs of depression. Depression is so debilitating. We see young clients with depression who have difficulty managing their finances. It's even worse when you're older. So looking at that, looking for signs of overdue payments perhaps on their utilities, and also being very cognizant of who your older parents are hanging out with, family and friends, because they can be some of the worst financial predators.
Hmm. All right, Scott, I'm afraid we need to leave it there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Bruce.
Scott Hanna is president and CEO with the Credit Counseling Society of BC. Stay with us. Coming up, Ask Anything. Our listener has a medical diagnosis that he thinks makes him uninsurable. But is that the case? And later, what to do if you win the lottery, aside from buying a Tesla or buying me a Tesla. Hey, I've written some books. Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. You can buy it online anywhere. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Ask anything, your chance to ask anything you want in the big, broad world of personal finance. Today, we're going to focus on insurance and a question as follows. I have a serious health issue. Is there anyone who will insure me? Lauren Marr is Director of Business Development at LSM Insurance. And Lauren, we don't know the specifics on the case here, but what are some of the circumstances that would make someone, I'm using air quotes here, make someone uninsurable or at least more difficult to insure?
Sure. Some of the issues that make someone more difficult to insure, one of them would be if they had a recent bout of cancer or if they're getting treatment for cancer, heart attack, certain levels. If any type of health issue, major health issue, is uncontrolled, that can also lead to a decline. So someone who has diabetes, but it's uncontrolled diabetes, so their blood sugar is not controlled, or if they, had any type of, certain mental nervous disorders that are not under control or not being properly medicated, that can result in a traditional application being declined.
What about chronic illnesses, those that aren't in and of themselves terminal, like Parkinson's or HIV or something like that? How do those fit in?
Well, HIV is an interesting one because some of the insurance companies, traditionally that was not an insurable illness in terms of getting life insurance, but a lot of the insurance companies are taking notice that people are living a lot longer with HIV, and they're now insuring them. So, depending on the condition, that would determine the extra risk rating that would be involved. And for people, and we'll probably get into this in a little bit, for people that are unable to qualify for traditional insurance, there's now a whole slew of no medical type policies. Mm. And those policies generally fall into two types of categories: simplified issue, where there are some health questions, and guaranteed issue, where there are no health questions.
So let's follow on that. Non-medical life insurance, go through each of those two categories.
Sure. So the simplified issue life insurance policy, they can be anywhere from 2 to 3 questions all the way up to 35 questions. And there are no medical tests. So someone applies for simplified issue life insurance policy, no medical tests, no needles, no meeting with the nurse. But there's anywhere from, like I said, 2 to 3 questions to 35 questions. The more questions you can answer no to, the better the premium. The second type of policy is guaranteed issue plan. These types of plans have no health questions and no medical tests. So they both have no medical tests, but the guaranteed issue has no health questions as well. Now, because there's no health questions, the cost is a lot higher on the guaranteed issue policies. There's also smaller face amounts. So usually those types of policies are limited to about $25,000 to $50,000, and there's usually a 2-year wait period. So person would have to wait 2 years, or the beneficiary would have to wait 2 years until the policy would pay out. Whereas simplified issue plans, there's a higher face amount, lower costs, and most of those plans pay out from day one.
So if you had a terminal cancer diagnosis, you would not be able to sign up for one of these simply.
You'd probably qualify for the guaranteed issue. Well, basically everybody qualifies for the guaranteed issue, but it's unlikely if you're getting cancer treatment, if you're currently getting cancer treatment, you're not going to qualify for a simplified issue policy.
How much do these programs cost, and do the insurance companies assume that you have, if you're going for the one with very little medical information, they must assume that you've got something really tough that you're dealing with?
Well, yeah, they're definitely pricing that in. So the once again, the plans where there are no questions, that's going to be your highest price. That's going to be your guaranteed issue plans. The simplified issue with two or three questions where you can answer no to only two or three questions, that's going to be definitely higher than a regular type of policy. It might be somewhere from around 2 to 2.5 times the premium. Now, the policies where you can answer no to 30 or 35 questions, those might be only, you know, an extra 25% above the regular premium.
But still, the payout would be limited. Like, you wouldn't be able to get $2 million.
On the ones where you can answer, let's say, 30 questions, you probably get a policy in the $1 million range, and you can also get more than one simplified issue policy. So you can that's where a broker can really come in who's familiar with that market, because they can basically match your illness up with the best no medical or the best simplified issue no medical policy for your condition, and they can also combine it with multiple carriers to optimize your coverage amount.
What are the consequences to lying? So I am not saying that anybody should do this, but I would bet people have tried to do this where they have endeavored to hide something from their files that would be material to their ability to get life insurance. What are the consequences and how does that play out? What should people be aware of?
Well, the most important consequence is that the policy may not pay out. So if a person passes away, the insurance company, especially if it's in the first 2 years, is going to verify the information on the application. Most of the insurance companies all have access to something called the MIB, the Medical Information Bureau. So if something matches up and it looks like something was off base, they investigate and it's material info that wasn't mentioned, like, you know, a past heart attack or something like that. There's a very good chance that policy is not going to pay out and the premiums are just going to be returned to the beneficiary.
How much fraud do you see?
On life insurance, you definitely see less than on disability and critical illness insurance, because one, with life insurance, you only have the person not fully disclosing on the application. With disability and critical illness, you have that plus you have ambiguity with if the policy should pay out for certain illness or disability.
Right. And then you've got the private investigator hovering in the bushes in front of their house to see that they went golfing yesterday.
Yeah. Whereas the life insurance, it's pretty clear cut if the person's dead or alive. I mean, there's been examples of that.
I would say that's fair to say.
Yeah. So that part of it results in a lot lower denial. And from my experience, it's under 2%.
Right. Lauren, thank you for your insight on this. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Ray of Hope for people who are dealing with some pretty tough circumstances. Lauren Marr is Director of Business Development at LSM Insurance. Well, stay with us. Coming up next, this is a textbook 1% problem, or maybe 0.0001%. How to deal with your money when it jumps from 3 figures to 7 figures. We'll have some insight on how to handle sudden wealth. And Scott Hanna answers the Moolah La questionnaire. Subscribe to the podcast version of this show on iTunes. Easy to do.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Ellery. You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. Let's daydream for a moment. Your long-lost aunt, who was also the CEO of Big Five Bank, mentions you in her will. The lottery numbers you've been playing since your 20s finally hit the jackpot. That little social media startup you work for was just bought by Uber. Whatever the source, in our scenario, you now have sudden and enormous wealth. How does that affect your financial plan? I'm sure it does in many ways. Rob Harder is an investment advisor of the Family Wealth Group of IPC Securities. He joins us from Winnipeg, Manitoba. Hello there, Rob.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
Give me some examples of sudden wealth that you have seen. Maybe they are not any of the ones that I mentioned. Maybe they're simple. Maybe someone just sold their house in Vancouver or something and suddenly landed $20 million. But what's crossed your desk?
You know, the ones we've seen in our practice here are a little bit more predictable than kind of the examples you gave there. But it's, you know, people selling a small business that has done well and they reach a liquidity event and are able to, you know, retire and do that kind of thing. So it would mostly be inheritance, small business, farm sales, stuff like that, where people come into wealth, which is a little bit different than the surprise scenario. It's something that can be planned for.
The client comes in. Let's say it is a surprising one. The client comes in shell-shocked. Where do you start? Aside from getting them a big drink.
Right, absolutely. Well, the first thing that you need to note is an influx will change and give you the freedom to change how you spend money. So it's prudent to pause before changing your spending patterns and create a plan that allows you to understand exactly how much you can actually afford to spend. Sometimes, you know, going out and buying a big house brings with it some unintended consequences, like a much bigger property tax bill. So depending on the scenario, there's, you know, the starting point is the plan.
What are some of the big tax questions that someone with that sort of a windfall, and I know they'd be different depending on where the money comes from, but what are the big tax questions you would walk them through?
So that's a great question, because the tax consequences are different in each scenario. So actually, interestingly, I was listening to a talk radio here in Winnipeg last week, and people were calling in talking about inheritance tax, and inheritance tax isn't something in Canada. We don't have that. So if you receive an inheritance or the sale of a principal residence in Vancouver, like you mentioned, those are tax-free amounts. If it's the sale of a business, there's definitely tax consequences, which are usually planned for along with the sale of the business. So bringing your accountant and lawyer into the picture on that discussion is very important so you make that transaction as tax efficient as possible. The bigger change for this influx of wealth happens once you have that in your hands, and there it really becomes a factor of how you invest it and how you optimize the tax efficiency along the way. So once you graduate to a new level of wealth, you need a fresh analysis of your financial situation, and that might mean implementing new investment strategies and really focusing on the tax aspects of them.
What are some of the vehicles that the super rich have access to that others don't? I mean, for average people, they can put their money in an exchange-traded fund, a mutual fund, whatever. But there are other vehicles that people of more significant wealth can take advantage of.
Yeah, absolutely. Today's high net worth investors should be expecting more from their advisor and from the type of plans they're invested in. They need a type of portfolio where they can have a clear understanding of what exactly is in it, unlike a mutual fund or ETF where it's a little bit opaque. They should understand what transactions are taking place and exactly what their costs of investment are. So the types of portfolios that would create that level of transparency would be like a separately managed account. That allows them to invest in vehicles like stocks, bonds, mutual funds, ETFs, but yet still have that clear picture of what exactly is in their portfolio.
I would want properties in multiple countries. I would want lots of houses. What are the complexities that come with that?
Absolutely. And we've seen a lot of Canadians over the years investing in property, particularly in the U.S. You know, when they had their housing crash, a lot of and the Canadian dollar was at par or above at that time, a lot of people took advantage of that. It's really, you know, something that it's worth engaging a tax expert in that foreign country to help you understand all of the implications of it. As advisors here in Winnipeg, we've got lots of clients that own property in the States, but we're not able to advise them on that tax situation. They need, you know, someone with the proper expertise in that foreign country to give them that advice.
What needs to change in terms of mindset? So someone who has sudden wealth is in a very different set of circumstances than they were the day before they received news of that wealth, even if it's not in their bank account yet. What counsel would you provide on that front?
Well, the first thing is, you know, to start thinking about their wealth in a different perspective. So when you're, you know, in your a normal working life, people are thinking about, you know, saving for retirement and meeting their day-to-day needs. What tends to change when people come into an influx of sudden wealth is you're able to think beyond your own needs and look beyond in terms of creating a legacy for the next generation of your family and future generations, as well as, you know, what we hear from a lot of our clients, we spend a lot of time working with them on, is philanthropic endeavors. And that can be a great tool to engage the next generation of your family and helping decide that and teaching them some money management skills and tools, but also that next perspective is thinking of what legacy you're going to leave, whether that's philanthropic or wealth to the future generations of your family.
What advice do you have for parents as it relates to their kids? Because the dynamics of old money versus new money are quite different. If someone has got money that has been in the family for generations, they may have a different view of legacy than someone who, for whom this is the first time. This is it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing we find with intergenerational money is there's a process that those families go through in terms of teaching and training their children in how to handle money, how to make money management decisions, how to invest, as well as encouraging them to find success on their own outside of the family money that they know that they will come into one day. So what my business partner and I do is we spend a lot of time with our clients helping them use tools to engage their children. We have some books that we share with them. One of them, I'll just throw it out there, is called The Opposite of Spoiled by Ron Lieber. Great book for people, for wealthy families, to help teach them strategies they can use with their children so that they are respectful and worthy of the family wealth that's passing on to them.
It's a bit of a stereotype on the lottery win, but I would bet it happens more often than not, is the phone starts to ring. People are so thrilled and happy to congratulate you on, and I mean lottery not necessarily literally, but with sudden wealth in all its facets. How do you advise people to deal with those calls?
Yeah, and that's a really tough one because most people, you know, they care about the people who are calling them, their family or friends that are in need. And it really comes back to creating a proper financial plan. So what we do is we start with, you know, what are your lifestyle goals as a family? What do you want to have in terms of income coming in and where is that coming from? So we build out that plan. And that'll require a certain portion of that wealth, whatever percentage or dollar amount of it that is. Then the remainder, we make sure we've built in a component for, an excess cash liquidity where people, call it a slush fund or access to other liquid cash should needs arise. Then we want to cover off the needs of their immediate family in terms of that legacy you want to pass on to the next generation, as well as philanthropic goals. And then this kind of helping out friends and family falls possibly under that philanthropic area. So once you know what you need to meet your own needs, it allows you to have comfort that if you want to help people out, you know how much you can afford to do without compromising your own financial success.
Rob, I appreciate your insight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce. It's great chatting with you.
And I hope one of us, preferably me, comes into sudden wealth. And then I'll have all of that problem to deal with. Thanks very much. Rob Harder, an investment advisor of the Family Wealth Group of IPC Securities. He was in Winnipeg today. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. It's our series of questions about money. And I'm going to ask our guest to provide the first thought that comes to, in this case, his mind. Scott Hanna is president and CEO of the Credit Counseling Society of BC. Scott, you ready?
I'm ready, Bruce.
How would you describe your money personality?
Very conservative.
Twas ever thus? Were you always conservative?
Yes, from a very young age. Fortunately, my parents taught me some lessons early, and they sunk in.
What is one of those lessons that you recall being imprinted on you at a young age?
I was 10 years old, and I received a weekly allowance of 25 cents. And the deal was I could spend 15 cents, I had 10. And one time, my friends convinced me to spend the other 10 cents on candy as well. My mom became aware of this, and when allowance day rolled around the next week, there was no allowance. That's a lesson learned.
Wow. Gosh, she's hardcore, man.
She was good.
She's good. Hey, what is one money topic you could write about, talk about every single day? You would never lose your passion for it.
It's really setting your own values, as opposed to feeling pressure from those around you.
And what is one topic you wish you never, ever, ever had to write about or talk about again?
The impact of not saving for retirement, the regret. People who are older and for the last 30, 40 years look back with regret saying, I didn't and I should have, and I find a position.
When do you plan to retire, and what will you do?
I plan to consider retirement in 5 years, but will be able to retire sooner financially. And when I retire, I intend to take on nonprofit board responsibilities, continue to improve my golf game, stay connected with my community and family, but live a very active retirement.
How good's your golf game now? Like, how much work is this going to take? Is this a full-time job getting that golf game sorted out?
It's going to be somewhat of a part-time there, but also giving back on nonprofit boards. I sit on a couple right now, but I believe in giving back to the community. You get a tremendous amount of value, but more importantly, it keeps your mind sharp.
Aside from that incident with the candy back when you were 10, which is, I can see is still traumatic for you, what was your worst financial mistake? What has been your worst financial mistake?
Buying a townhouse with a friend.
Ah.
And not picking out his financial background first and realizing after the fact that I was the one who had to take on the responsibility for the mortgage.
If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, you had this magical power, what behavior would you change?
I would ensure they understood the importance of living within their means and not exceeding it.
That's good. I'll second that. Scott, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bruce.
Scott Hanna, President and CEO of Credit Counseling Society of British Columbia. And that is our program for today. Thank you all for joining us. You can listen to past episodes by heading on over to iTunes. They're downloadable there. They're also available on moolala.ca. Full episodes as well as individual segments, so you can choose the ones that you want to listen to. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. That's spelled M-O-O-L-A-L-A.ca. At Bruce Selry on Twitter, Facebook, Bruce Selry, Moolala. Thanks very much for listening, and have a great rest of your day.